and because apparently my charisma isn't enough for everyone, we would like to thank the Toronto Public Library and the Beguiling, the presenters of the Toronto Comics Art Festival. Thanks also to Seneca College, our program sponsor. In the meantime, you're probably really sick and tired of hearing me yell at you. So I will get off the stage, and you can all watch and listen for what you've been waiting for. Give it up!
Her voice is louder than the microphone.
No, I know.
I don't even know why we're here.
You should just do this.
Also, to the people who asked me if you could record, it is okay. I also forgot to mention
that. Don't make me look fat.
Yes. Do not make Ed look fat, or he will sue you.
I can do that.
Well, thanks everyone for coming to this. My name is Andrew Murray.
I'm Adam Lyons.
We both run a podcast here in Toronto called Guys with Pencils. It focuses on art and animation and comics. And we were asked to do the moderating for the Ed Brubaker panel here about noir comics.
And we will try to talk as little as possible.
Yeah, because we're not that.
We're not Ed Brubaker.
Yeah. So, Ed, noir comics, go.
I might need a tiny bit more direction.
Well, I mean, like we were talking about it before, it's, you know, we've seen a bunch of other interviews where people are just kind of like, so how'd you get into this, and what do you like about it, and stuff like that. Is there a general kind of way you could give the audience an idea about your relation to noir, the noir genre?
Well, yeah, I grew up watching noir movies, and my dad's sister was married to a guy named John Paxton, who was a famous noir screenwriter. He wrote The Wild One and On the Beach and Murder My Sweet and Crossfire. And so I always, as a kid, he would, you know, one of his movies was on TV, and my dad would make us all watch it. And so I just kind of grew up watching all that stuff, and we would go up to L.A. and go to Disneyland and stay at their house, and I could see all his awards and screenplays and stuff. So I just kind of, it was just always part of my life that he was one of the reasons I think I ended up becoming a writer, was because I had someone in my life who, that's what they did for a living, is they wrote movies. Mm-hmm. And it just, because you have to see that someone else does something when you're a kid to know that that's a job you could grow up to have. And I think because of that, I also didn't realize how hard it would actually be to grow up to be a writer. So I just was like, oh, this is just something someone does. So I never had any moment of thinking, oh, this is going to be too hard to actually do. But because of that, I've been watching like old noir films since I was a little kid, and then I grew up a huge Marvel nerd, but I also loved old newspaper strips, and my dad would take us to the library a lot, and I would dig through old, like the library had the Russ Cochran EC reprints, and I read a lot of the horror stuff, but I thought a lot of art, like Ghastly, I remember it was like an artist who I thought was way too gross to look at. And so I ended up gravitating towards like the shock suspense stories and crime suspense stories. And I was probably 12 or 13 years old, and I was reading those. And I loved that there was this era of comics where crime comics were bigger than superheroes or anything. And I loved that at the end of the 40s, when superheroes weren't selling anymore, that all the publishers just decided to try to do different things like romance comics and westerns and just throw a bunch of stuff out and see what sells. And so I kind of was always really attracted to that. And when I first was doing my own comics, I was doing sort of semi-autobiographical comics. And when I was a teenager, I was kind of a bad kid, and I did a lot of drugs and committed a lot of crimes. And so I had a lot of grist for the mill. And so one of my comics I did was a sort of my true crime story. It was an issue of this comic Lowlife that I wrote and drew. And after that, people started asking me to write stories for them, like friends of mine. And I just kind of fell backwards into being a writer instead of a cartoonist. And just anytime someone would give me would want me to write a story for them, I would end up writing a crime story. And the first one I did was a thing called Accidental Death that Eric Schanauer drew. And ended up getting nominated for 4 or 5 Eisner Awards for it. And it was, Eric and I both grew up in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Our parents were both Navy brats. And I lived there about 4 or 5 years before him. And but we lived 2 houses apart from each other on the same block because our dads were both in the Navy. And I lived there for 3 years, from like 72 to 75 or something. Wow. And so we had that in common, and we were Eric really wanted to do a contemporary thing, and all his ideas, he was already starting to work on Age of Bronze back then. This is, God, like over 20 years ago or something. And he really wanted to do something contemporary because he was a huge fan of like Love and Rockets and Lloyd Llewellyn and all these sort of alternative comics. And he felt like when he went to give any of those people he loved his work, all he had were these Oz books, and they would look at them and not really respect what he was doing. And so he wanted something contemporary, but he didn't have any contemporary ideas, so he offered me a chance to write something for him. And that was kind of how I stumbled into a career, honestly. I was like, well, we both lived in Gitmo, let's do something in Gitmo. You draw dwarves really well, let's do something that has a dwarf in it. and then we just kind of came up with a crime story, a murder mystery that took place in Gitmo in the 70s where we both lived there. And he had all this photo reference for it. So, and from that, I just started getting offers to do other work. And I sort of ended up accidentally doing superhero comics. I hadn't thought that I had any ideas for them, and I just wanted to write crime stuff, and I thought, oh, there's probably no way I'm going to make a living doing that. And I had gotten to do Scene of the Crime at Vertigo with Michael Lark, and I was at a festival in Savannah at the College of Art and Design there, SCAD, and I met Mike Carlin, who had been reading Scene of the Crime, and asked me if I wanted to write Batman. And I said, oh, I don't want to write superheroes. And he said, well, if you can write a mystery story, you can write Batman.
Yeah.
And then I thought about it, and suddenly I had all these ideas for Batman. And then I went home and I watched a bunch of the Bruce Timm and Paul Dini Batman cartoons. And then I called him up and I said, can I write the Batman animated comic? And he said, no, we wanted you to write the actual Batman comic. I was like, this one's really cool. So I was like crazy, because I thought I'd write the one that doesn't sell, that's aimed at 8-year-olds who are, that's all bought by adults. So I just kind of stumbled into that side of it, and I always tried to bring, whatever I did, I always tried to bring some of my own interests, like my noir and espionage and things like that, into whatever else I was doing, which I think sort of ended up becoming my style, I guess, by default, was just, I was taking like Captain America or Batman and writing a story that I wanted to read that was in that world, really. But really the second that I got a chance to just do whatever the hell I wanted to do was, you know, when I had the deal at Marvel, I was, you know, just done the death of Captain America, which was the biggest selling comic of the decade, until they did that that Spider-Man where the guy was pretending to be Obama at the back 8 pages. I like Obama, but they sold more copies than me. They broke my record. And it wasn't even him, it was the chameleon. So it was just a guy wearing an Obama mask. But I did that comic, and then because of that, I had, you know, a lot of clout at Marvel, and I said, well, I want to do a crime comic through Icon, you know, and Sean and I had been Sleeper together, and I just thought, I'll try and figure out a way to create an umbrella title where I can do anything that I want to do, and it's sort of like Sin City, but I described it at the time as like sort of like Sin City, but if someone leapt off of a building and landed on a car 5 stories below, they'd die, and the people in the car would die. Not, they would leap off and run down the street, and the cops would jump out and shoot at them. I was like, no, that's a superhero comic that looks like a crime comic. Yeah. So, and I love Frank Miller and I love Sin City, but I wanted to do something that was much more like, you know, what Darwin's ended up doing, like the Parker books.
Oh, yeah.
And you know, when Darwin and I were working together on Catwoman, that's all we would talk about was like those Parker novels and all this
so
pulp stuff that we both loved that we wished we could figure out a way to make a living doing that stuff instead of the superhero stuff. As much as we were having fun, and I think our Catwoman is still the best version of Catwoman that's ever existed, so other than maybe some of the stuff in the cartoon, which I like too, but I think, you know, I haven't been able to look at Catwoman since I stopped working on it, so, and, you know, but I loved, when I got to work on it, all the girls dressed up as Catwoman who would come up to talk to us at conventions who were just like super fans of that, and they were so happy that we did a Catwoman that wasn't like, that didn't make them feel ill when they read it. So I was doing, you know, Captain America and a bunch of books at Marvel, and then Sean and I started doing Criminal, and that was kind of when I realized, oh, we can actually get away with this. And, you know, we seem to have built like, unbelievably, Sleeper, which I don't know if any of you read Sleeper, at the time it was coming out, it was, like, one of DC's worst-selling comics. And I hear, like, and Gotham Central. Like, Gotham Central and Sleeper, I hear about more now than when we were actually working on them. And it's great, I feel, but Bendis and I were talking about this, and we, it's like, we feel like the world is starting to catch up to us, finally. Like, look at, you know, I mean, the Winter Soldier movie, the Gotham TV series, show. Yeah. You know, it's just, I feel like the world is, like, our aesthetic has started to become, you know, part of the mainstream pop culture, finally, yeah, yeah. Which is nice, but I wish they'd pay us for it.
So, this, I can't help but feel like this question is going to be kind of corny, but when researching for the panel, you know, looking up, like, what is noir, what does it mean, what does that contain, all that right there.
This isn't a puppet.
Oh, you're baby, my, you made me a velvet puppet. I'm so psyched. No one's ever made me a puppet before. Someone gave me a Winter Soldier action figure that they made like 10 years ago before you could just buy them at like Kmart.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So in the future, everybody make him puppets.
Yeah, I love puppets. Actually, my wife's cousin, anyone here know what The Best Show is?
Yeah.
Yeah. But, so you know the puppet on The Best Show? My wife's cousin made that. She's obsessed with it. She made a Will Wheaton puppet that looks exactly like it. It's really horrible.
Vance puppet or Gary the Squirrel?
Vance. Gary the Squirrel, I think, didn't actually exist for a long time. They just talked about it, and then they finally had someone make one. But you know, she made the Vance puppet. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Sorry.
No.
Sidetrack. Okay, back to your corny question.
That was really more. But yeah.
I wish you were talking about puppetry for the next. I'm going to teach you guys how to juggle. I don't know how to juggle. We're turning this thing into a Ren fair.
What was I saying? Oh, yeah. So, noir. You know, doing. So, you know, like, doing research for the panel and stuff like that, there's all these, like, technical breakdowns on, like, what it is, this is what it is in movies, and I'm just kind of curious, like, what does it mean to you, like, when somebody says that, because every time, like, you're Googled,
yeah,
noir,
oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? So
it can, like, transcend different cultures as well, because, like, I mean, when you think of...
Well, it's a French word, yeah.
Yeah, when you think of, like...
Description for books that only sold in France.
But it was like, you know, I mean, American style noir genre, it's like that,
yeah.
I think that's something that everyone kind of pictures, but I mean, when you think of, does that, through other cultures?
At the time that the films from the late 30s through the mid-50s were coming out, I think it was only in the late 40s or early 50s they actually started, the word noir became associated with them. It was originally, they just were thought of as melodramas or thrillers. Mm. But they all, you know, have the, you know, the ending where the hero dies or drives off a bridge or does the thing that the girl told him to do and then she murders him.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, what does it mean to me? I don't know. Honestly, I think just like the French, it's more of just like you know it when you see it, kind of. Like Memento is totally noir to me, but it's all daylight. I don't think you can afford to shoot at night, probably. But. Like, a lot of people will look at something and really judge whether or not it's noir based on a set of criteria. And for me, it's really about the characters and what their story is. I mean, the problem with noir is that generally you can't have a happy ending. And I was talking to a friend of mine about this recently, and they said, why doesn't your stuff sell as well as Saga does? I'm like, well, thanks. And I thought about it for a couple minutes, and I was like, well, because Brian Vaughn does stories that are, like, fun and happy, and you can root for these people, and you want them and their baby to get out and all this stuff. And I do comics where it's, like, this guy who's maybe losing his mind who gets seduced by, like, a stripper who then wants him to murder somebody. And then you're just wondering, like, how badly is it going to go for this guy? You're not wondering if he's going to get out. You're like, this guy's never getting out of this. So it's like, you're rooting to see, God, I hope that doesn't end that badly. So that's kind of to me is what noir is like, it's a way to examine characters. Like, for me, all story comes from character, and the way I come up with stories often is, you know, I carry a notebook around with me, and if I see someone that's doing something interesting, I jot that down because I think, well, this guy is a mobile locksmith. He breaks into cars for a living, like, legally. Like, that would be a totally great profession for someone to have in a noir story, and I just write that down, and that just sits in my notebook until eventually I get around to looking, you know, trying to create a new character and thinking about, like, well, what do they do? And then I'm like, oh, they break into cars for a living, but legally. And then they break into the wrong car, you know, or something. I'm just making that up. But don't steal that. That's
yeah, that's
the break into car guy story by Andrew Baker.
Please call it that, too, the title.
Yeah, the break into car guy story.
Yeah.
That's cool. I was going to call it Locksmith. That's kind of, I get into, every story for me, you know, comes from the character, and then you build around it, and, you know, the noir aesthetic for me is really, you know, the look of it, and the way Sean draws. Like, Sean, it's funny, like, Sean always gets asked when we do panels, like, what his favorite noir film is, and Sean doesn't actually watch old noir films. Like, he doesn't really, he'll buy the DVDs if I'm talking about them, or if he's going to do an illustration for an article about one or something, but he goes to, like, movies with his kids and watches Pixar movies. I mean, I like that stuff, too, but I'm, like, a huge noir aficionado, and I would, you know, curate my own noir fest if it was up to me. So, but he just loves drawing clothing folds and smoke and darkness, and it's really great for him to, you know, go, I mean, that's easy. You just fill in all the background with black. Drawing buildings. So it's just a way into the character, and I like, you know, I'm of the school of the way to write is to put your character in the worst place they could possibly be, and that's what all noir is about. Mm. You know, noir is, you know, Fred McMurray walking into Barbara Stanwyck's house and falling in love immediately and then having to murder her husband for her. And, you know, that's great.
So you must have really enjoyed then in Toy Story 3 when they were in that garbage pit.
Oh my god, that was the best part of that movie. When that little girl stole all those toys from him. God. I mean, he's acting like he's just going to let her play with them, and then she keeps them all. She's the youngest femme fatale.
Yeah. It was interesting, you were saying though that when you were, you know, when you were making up these stories, like and coming up with the stuff in the 70s, and were you... You know, you talked about how I guess it was the 40s, and superheroes were not doing so good, so they were just kind of putting everything out there. When you were coming along and doing it, were you kind of getting any sort of, like, backlash saying, like, no, superheroes is what we want, and we don't really like noir, why would we want noir? That stuff, you know, they had a big Senate debate about that kind of stuff in Pulp Fiction and stuff, right? So, I mean, like, did you ever kind of get any resistance from anyone about doing your crime stories?
Well, no, I mean, because we were doing it through Icon, we were basically the publishers. Marvel put up the money for the printing, and we took all the risk and everything on that. So they didn't really have any control on it. Adding stuff like crime and noir into, like, Batman and Captain America and stuff like that, we never got any flack for it because... We got great reviews, and, you know, Captain America was, you know, one of Marvel's best-selling books while I was writing it, and so I think they just liked what I was doing. They loved, like, adding, like, a sort of hardcore espionage layer to, like, the Marvel universe. I mean, as you can see, all their movies have, like, that aspect, and like, the stuff that Millar was doing in The Ultimates is just all over the aesthetic of their movies, so, you know, I had never heard a word the whole time I've been in comics about the comics code. I never had anyone at DC ever go, oh, the code won't let us do that. Like, they didn't care. By like the late 90s, the code was basically like just two guys in an office somewhere, like looking at Archie Comics and going, oh, Jughead's getting high. And now he's just eating burgers.
I saw that in an interview. You said, and someone said to you, like, what would you like to write? And you're like, oh, I'd love to write Jughead.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, Roberto Gary Sacasa is now the head, and he runs Archie now, and I thought, I should call him up and ask him if he'll give me Jughead for a year, and I thought, oh, well, they'd never be able to use Jughead again after that. It would be, I should see the last page, he's just enormous, and there's just burgers everywhere. He's lying on the ground, he can't move, and there's, like, Big Ethel's, like, standing over him, like, laughing. As she's smoking a cigarette. Or maybe a joint, I don't know.
Yeah, then you could brag, you could say, like, I had the highest selling Jughead.
Yeah, I would have read that. I know. There's a part of me, that used to be my dream of retirement was that my dream of retirement is working, but I thought someday I'll retire from all this and just write Jughead for a living. Like, wait a second, that's not retirement. But yeah, I love old Archie comics. I, you know, every time I was sick, my dad would buy a bunch of RG Digests and stuff when I was a little kid, and I was homesick with the flu. I would just sit and read Betty and Veronica and Jughead and Pep and all that stuff. So I have a huge affection for any Archie comic that came out pre-1975, before the art started to suck. It's not the art that sucked, actually. It's the way that the inking and coloring, actually. The pencils are still... Yeah. They still... I mean, it's like all Archie comics almost look the same, but that old... Anything before 1975 has this really great lush brush-style inking, like Seth or something, you know?
Didn't they just kill him?
I think they are killing Archie right now, yeah. But just in the life with Archie, I guess they're doing a death with Archie issue or something.
They should have got you to write that.
Well, I would have loved to, actually, but I, you know, that was interestingly when one of my favorite comics I've ever written is the last criminal story we did, The Last of the Innocent, which was sort of my version of what happens when Archie grows up. But it was also partly inspired by Patricia Highsmith, who wrote The Talented Mr. Ripley and Strangers on a Train, had a brief career as a comic book writer, and I thought, how weird would it have been if Patricia Highsmith had been given Archie? And so I kind of did the what if Archie was the talented Mr. Ripley. But also it was inspired by my dad passed away a few years ago, and when he was dying, I went through a big, you know, as you do, like a really big nostalgic thing about looking back at my childhood, and I was digging out my old comics, and it was right around, you know, pre-Christmas, and so all the Rankin and Bass Christmas specials were on, so I was kind of awash in nostalgia for my youth, and then I saw that they were doing this Archie comic where he grows up and marries Veronica, and I thought, oh, I'm going to go get that, and so I read them, and I was like, wait, because in that comic, and no one from Archie, please get mad at me about this, but in the comic, he goes down like a path in the woods, and when he comes out, it's college graduation. And of course, because he's just graduated college, he needs to now start adult life, which the first thing you do when you start adult life is choose which of the two girls that you're dating you need to propose to, because you're 22 and you've graduated college, so you're clearly ready to be a full adult. So he picks Veronica, and he marries her, and everything goes great, and they are married for like 10 years, and they have kids, and it's Christmas Eve, and he's like, this is the best life anyone could ever have. And then he goes for a walk in the woods, and he sees the path that he took, and he decides to take the other path, and he quotes from Robert Frost, not taken, and then he comes out the woods the other side, and it's college graduation again, and he's like, I'm going to marry Betty this time. And then he marries Betty, and everything's perfect then, too. And I was like, one has to be better than the other. Like, you can't have either choice would have been the perfect choice. So it made me kind of angry, and I was like, you know what I want to do? I want to do, like, my version of what happens when Archie grows up.
What would happen?
Where there's consequences, and throw in, like, my own crazy noir stuff, and have it take place in, like, the gross Reagan 80s of America, and really do sort of, you know, this twisted thing where the flashbacks are all drawn like these perverted kids comics. And so I also, it's called The Last of the Innocent because it's named after The Seduction of the Innocent, and I tried to put as many things that Dr. Wortham complained about into the comic as possible. And that's why Archie kills Veronica with injury to the eye motif. So that was kind of, you know, it was therapy and sort of getting out my love of Archie in the most twisted way possible. But it's interesting, Brandon Graham was at my house a couple weeks ago, and he looked at my shelf of graphic novels, and he's like, huh, way more Archie than I expected. And I was like, you don't have the Harry Lucy book? Like, how could you call yourself a cartoonist? This is really weird. You look exactly like my old roommate. I'm going to take a picture and text it to him afterwards.
You owe me some rent, by the way.
Yeah. No, I was covering him. Actually, our other roommate was covering both of us.
Oh, I lost my question.
All right. Sorry. Archie, twisted.
Oh, so yeah. Part of, like, noir, I feel like there's a lot of focus on, like, all the characters in one way or another are really shitty human beings. I'm just kind of curious, do you feel that way? Because, like, I don't think so,
honestly. I think in noir, sometimes there are people who are just pure evil in a noir story, but I feel like even the talented Mr. Ripley is trying to figure out how to be a human. Mm-hmm. You know, even Tom Ripley is trying. He's like Dexter or something. He's a psychopath. He's pretending to be like the people he wishes he was, and that's like one of the darkest books ever. And I feel like most noir is about good people who make the wrong decision. I mean, every single person in this room, you know, probably within the last week has made a wrong decision. You know, like they wish that they hadn't had that extra drink, or they wish that they didn't make out with that guy or girl, or, you know, whatever. Everybody makes the wrong decision. I mean, it's a weekend. We were all drinking last night. You guys did a lot of stupid stuff in this bar, I'm sure. I was here last night. There was stupid shit happening. And I, like, everybody makes the wrong decision, and that to me is noir is about the consequences of good people doing the wrong thing. Sometimes. Sometimes it's also about some guy realizing he wants to get out of his marriage and the only way out is to kill his wife. So, because she has all the money. So, it is a bit of that. I mean, but honestly, I think the reason that it works as a genre and the reason that people, you know, that those old movies are great is, I mean, my favorite movie probably is Out of the Past, which is a Robert Mitchum movie. And Robert Mitchum's character in that is amazing. He's a private eye hired by a mobster to find the mobster's runaway mall, and he chases her down to Acapulco or someplace like that, and finds her and falls in love with her immediately. And she says, you know, I've done terrible things. And he has the best line of his entire career. He says, baby, I don't care. And then they start making out. And then they run off together, and then the mobster hires someone else to track them down. And then it turns out, yeah, she has done terrible things, and she's an awful person, and he's totally in love with her, and it ruins his life, falling in love with the wrong woman. And, like, to me, that's just one of the greatest stories ever, because he runs off from away from her, cleans up his act, meets a nice girl, starts to settle down with her, and then his old life comes back to him. And he ends up, basically, like, there's a moment in that movie where, at the end of the movie, the good girl, basically is given permission to think that he was a bad guy so that she can move on with her life. And it's amazing, because it's like it's this great heroic sacrifice that only the viewer knows happened. You know, and the little deaf kid. He sign languages that he was a bad guy. Spoilers. The movie came out 46 years ago. It's on you for not having seen it.
Do you, is there anything that's kind of, I mean, it sounds like you're obviously really influenced by a lot of older movies, but is there anything on, whether it be TV, film, or books that you're reading now that really, that's like a noir-style genre that you are liking right now?
I think The Americans is probably the best show on TV currently, like for cable in America.
That's the one with their, like, spies.
They're Russian spies in the early 80s. Yeah, it's like, it starts like about a year into Reagan's presidency, okay, when the Cold War was heating up again, and I'm that's a show that makes me so angry because I didn't come up with it. And also, I actually was like, I called my agents and I said, can you get me staff on that show? And he said, well, the writing room's in New York. Do you want to move to New York to work on it? And I was like, oh, no. I just signed a lease. But I also, it is one of those things where it was like a double-edged sword. Like, I would have loved to work on it because the guy who created the show is an ex-CIA op, and my uncle that I'm named after was really high up in the CIA, and I would love to, you know, meet this guy and talk to him more about the actual CIA, because, you know, I can't get access. I have a lot of his stuff from retirement, because he was one of those guys who was outed in that book about CIA ops in the 60s, so he was able to actually get his retirement medal and stuff, because everybody, yeah, a lot of CIA operatives around the world were outed in a book in the early 60s.
Really?
Yeah, that was distributed around Europe and Asia and stuff, and, yeah, so it's a really interesting story, but yeah, that show is amazing. I loved Breaking Bad, obviously.
Oh, yeah.
I think The Sopranos is actually probably the biggest influence on me realizing that the kind of stuff I liked was the kind of stuff I could actually get paid to write. And the first episode of The Sopranos I ever saw was the one where he takes Meadow to look at colleges and runs it across the guy and wins protection and has to murder him. That was the finest thing I'd ever seen on television at that point, and I thought, how the fuck did someone get away with this? And then I thought, oh, I want to write stories like that. And then Sleeper, the biggest influence on Sleeper was The Sopranos, honestly. Like, there was a little bit of Donnie Brasco in the high concept, but really I was the reason each issue feels like a self-contained thing was because I wanted it to be like an HBO show on paper. Basically, the only HBO show at that point was really The Sopranos.
Yeah.
I think The Wire was obviously one of the best things that's ever been on TV. Actually, there's a Canadian show, Intelligence, that was one of the best shows ever.
You're all thinking it, I know.
Did you see it?
No.
That's really great. It's about a pop dealer who gets involved with the CIA. It's really great. It's actually a friend of mine who was an intelligence agent said it's the best, up to that point, was the best, most realistic depiction of how the intelligence agencies actually use criminals as for human intel. So.
But I think it's tricky with a lot of Canadian shows because like we got, I saw...
Stephen Harper had that one canceled. Like, honestly, no, I talked to the guy who created the show, and, like, literally Stephen Harper. I guess when you're in the Premiership of Canada, like, one of the few powers you have is to cancel the season. Because, like, you don't have a quorum, I guess, because there's, like, 8 Liberal parties. Or, I don't know. I don't understand why you guys Liberal parties can't team up and fight crime. But
Which is it's funny to my point, because I saw a billboard, like, a couple of weeks ago, and there's this show in Canada called Murdoch Mysteries. And on it, it said, like...
It's a steampunky thing.
It was like, it's like Canada's number one crime drama. And I'm like, it's Canada's only crime drama. Which Prime Minister Stephen Harper had a cameo in. I'm like,
oh my god. That's so funny. Yeah, Chris Haddock told me Intelligence didn't get a third season because he did Da Vinci's Inquest, I guess.
Oh, okay. And
the guy that Da Vinci's based on is actually in Parliament now. He's like used to be the mayor of Vancouver.
Okay.
He's based on like a real guy who became the mayor of Vancouver. Okay. And Stephen Harper hates that guy. He's like his arch enemy or something.
This is a show I would watch where Stephen Harper's angry at people and he's like, cancel that show.
Harper Stephen. I know more about Rob Ford than I know about Stephen Harper, honestly. Because everybody knows about Rob Ford. He's like the best mayor since Marion Barry. He's awesome. You guys are 20 years behind us on the crack smoking mayor. I don't understand. Have you guys had disco yet? What did you say?
Sadly, but at least it's gone now here.
Oh, good.
I don't think he's gone.
No, he's...
Disco.
Oh, disco. Yeah.
Wow, you guys are like stumped.
Yeah. Well, sorry, we talked about it before, and it's just like.
I thought we should do wait, don't tell me now.
Sure. Well, I mean, going on about the TV show stuff, I mean, okay, so you have so many credentials in regards to, like, not just doing your writing with the comics, and I mean, you know, even film that too with The Winter Soldier.
Yeah. Okay.
But, like, you're even acting now too, right?
Oh my god, I wasn't acting. I was trying to act like I wasn't there.
If you've seen The Winter Soldier, then you've seen Ed in it. He had a small cameo.
I'm scientist number two.
Yeah.
I had a line of dialogue. That was weird. What's weird is me and the scientist number one and the Winter Soldier actually all had Russian dialogue in that scene. It was thankfully edited out. But I practiced. People were asking me, were you really nervous to work with Robert Redford? And I was like, work with Robert Redford, yeah. No, I was all day standing there trying to memorize my line of dialogue in Russian over and over again. I didn't have time to be nervous about being on screen with Robert Redford other than that I hate having my picture taken at all. So, I'm like, well, I'm going to be in a scene with Robert Redford. That's weird. But really, I had a line of Russian, which I'll tell you while I was... Vipani Marija.
But I mean,
that's actually like an Italian accent for Russian. I don't understand. It's kind of do you accept?
And you were yelling that to the ref.
Yelling at the Winter Soldier.
Do you accept?
Yeah. Well, Pat Healy, who was scientist number one, who's a real actor, who was the star of a great movie called Cheap Thrills that you guys should all. I think it's on streaming right now. But he's a great guy and. He had more dialogue. He had dialogue with Redford, and he had dialogue with the Winter Soldier, and I just got to yell, "Leave it in my intro!" And thankfully, it got cut out. I wish that they had cut out the moment where I do like a comical, like Buster Keaton double take. That's the worst acting of all time. I will tell anyone, if you're ever going to be acting in the background in a scene, the best acting advice you'll ever get is just don't move your hands. Just put them in your pockets. That's it. Everyone stands so still. Like, that must be like the acting talent of when Robert Redford is talking to the camera, you're in the background, just don't move. Don't draw attention to yourself. Just stand there frozen. Because I looked at everyone else. Oh, there's a take where I'm literally going like, that's ridiculous.
I feel like I'm a scientist. I shouldn't think.
Yeah. I wonder how this Redford thing's going.
Well, would you ever, I mean, it's easy to say, like, I mean, yeah, I would love to do that, but I mean, you know, since you've covered so many other forms of media, would you ever be interested in taking that noir genre and, you know, trying to do, like, a TV show? Have you been asking around, being like, hey, I want to do a TV show, like, look what's going on?
Well, I mean, I moved to L.A. about 3 years ago, and partly because we had sold The Criminal as a movie for the first book, Coward, and I was writing that, and done about 5 drafts on that, and Kim Ji Woon is now attached to direct it, who made I Saw the Devil and Bittersweet Life, and he's a really great director, really great style, doesn't speak a word of English, so there's always 2 translators with him at any point, which is a little bit of a stumbling block to get used to at first, but then you realize he understands everything you're saying, you just can't understand a word he says. So but yeah, we're casting for that right now, and I wrote a movie that's being sold out of Cannes next week, I think, called Maniac Cop. That's a remake of a movie that Nicholas Refn is producing. It's an old Bruce Campbell.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that the Bruce Campbell
film? Yeah, I did. I wrote the remake of that. I've been working on that for about 9 months with Nicholas Refn, who made Drive and the Pusher trilogy. And
I'm in.
And but like, since I've been in LA, I sold 3 different TV pilots that then didn't end up getting filmed.
Really?
Because I sold them to networks, and they were very cable-y kind of ideas. And so I just, you know, the last couple months I finished a couple different drafts on those movies, and now I'm working on like a cable TV pilot that I can't really talk about. But
well, that's cool though.
Yeah, I do. I mean, I spend. The reason that I quit doing superhero comics was because I had been having about 10 years of people offering me screenwriting jobs that I didn't have the time to take. And I really wanted to, you know, I think TV right now I've got some of the best writing in the world happening. And so I wanted to take advantage of this before, you know, the fact that everyone in Hollywood is basically someone who grew up reading comics right now goes away. Because right now, like, I started going down to LA for meetings about movies and stuff a decade or so ago, and back then someone's assistant was really into comics and they'd have to explain to them who you were as you're walking into the room, and now it's like the head guy at HBO is like, you know, has my hardbacks waiting for me to sign when I walk in for a meeting. So
that's
like,
really, that's funny.
It's really, the nerds have taken over the entire industry. It is amazing. The people who aren't nerdy pretend to be now because it's cool to be, you know, to be into comics. So even people who aren't into comics are way into comics, pretend, you know. Right. You know, and I'm talking about the guys.
I heard an interview, too, that where a guy was saying, like, in the mid-90s, you know, when there was only, like, the Batman movies.
Yeah.
And they were saying, just like, well, we got this guy writing it. And then they were saying, like, what, DC's just like, why don't you go get comic writers to do it? And they're like, no, comics is its own thing. Like,
well, it really is a different language. I mean, I grew up, you know, when I was in high school, I drew my own comics, and we made tons of Super 8 movies, and I always was, by default, the director and writer, because I was the one who was, like, the control freak. And since I was a cartoonist, I always had the eye for where to put the lens and, you know, where to put the camera. So I was, you know, I always had that side in me, and I spent 10 years, you know, going down to Hollywood and writing screenplays that no one's seen, and learned a lot, even though I feel like the last year working on Maniac Cop with Refn was kind of like screenwriting boot camp, because I did so many drafts on that and learned so much from him. I mean, I think he's one of the best living filmmakers, actually, so I took that job mainly to work with him, and, you know, I'm a fan of the old movies, but I don't think, you know, I probably wouldn't have chased a monster movie right at this point in my career, but it was, you know, Nicholas Refn offering me a monster movie. I'm like, yeah, I'll fucking write a Nicholas Refn monster movie in a heartbeat. So that, you know, that's basically, I quit doing superhero comics so I could devote about half of my time to, you know, TV and film work and that stuff. But it really is a different language. There's 3, like, novels, what you're writing is exactly what the reader's getting. Comic scripts, you're writing to your artist. Everything that you write that's not the narration or dialogue is a description for your artist. But a movie script is written from the point of view of an audience that's watching something that doesn't exist yet. It's always, we're this, we look at this, so-and-so's standing here. And it's, you're in the moment. If you're doing it right, if anyone ever wants to become a screenwriter, the best thing you could do is get the Michael Clayton screenplay and read it about 100 times, because Tony Gilroy is probably the most economic screenwriter I've ever seen in my life. And every scene in that movie has to be there, and every description keeps you right in the moment, right there. So it's a different language, and I love it, actually. It's especially, what's weird is going from, you know, one week I'll be working on a screenplay, and then the next week I'll be working on a comic, and I realize how hard comics writing is, even though I've done it my whole life. Screenplays are, you don't have to worry about how many words per panel, or how many words per word balloon. You can write, because comics is deceptive. You try to write dialogue that feels like people talking, but it really isn't. Because if you read it out loud, this is the problem with the Watchmen movie, is that they used a lot of the dialogue directly from the comic, which is meant to be read, and in your head, you turn it into people talking. But people don't actually talk that way. It's very staged.
Yeah.
And so comics is a trick. It's more like poetry. You try to use as few words as you can get away with to get it across, but you can only use so many words per page, or you're going to have, Bendis is able to get away with a billion words per page, but no one else in comics has really ever been able to pull it off, I don't think. And I certainly struggle, every page of comic book writing is gets harder in a weird way, because you've written so many things. Like, it's sort of, I'm, 15, 18 years into a career now, I've written so many comic pages. Then now when I look at a page, I look at it in a completely different way than I did, when I was writing Scene of the Crime, which has word balloons that make me cringe when I look at it, because there's so many words. And I still love that book, but now I would have broken that up, one word balloon up into three or something. I'm always so worried about the pacing and how much time people spend on a panel and stuff like that. So it's definitely a different language.
This is you developing as an artist, too. I mean, we talk to a lot of different people. And anyone in their career, they always I'd hope that a lot of people would cringe at stuff that they did 15 years ago.
That's the idea.
No way, man, that thing I wrote back in 1991, perfect.
Harper Lee could never write anything as good as To Kill a Mockingbird again, so she just never wrote. honestly, you look at, there's a certain level to that. Like, you feel like you don't want to repeat yourself, but you're always writing the same story no matter what. Mm-hmm. Every writer basically approaches the same two or three stories over and over again from different angles. That was what drove me crazy about writing superhero comics, is that I got to a point where I felt like I couldn't figure out how to end stories anymore, because every story ended with a bunch of people putting on costumes and punching each other. And I thought, that is actually not an ending. That is a climax.
So we're at the tail end of this. Should we open it up to questions?
Yeah, sure. You guys have any questions?
Anybody?
What are your favorite undercover cop movies?
My favorite undercover cop movie? Infernal Affairs. Donnie Brasco. I don't know if it totally counts, but The Friends of Eddie Coyle is a great movie, and there's like a snitch in there. I don't know if that's really an undercover cop. You know that? Friends of Eddie Coyle is a Robert Mitchum movie. It was made by the guy who made Bullet. Same director. Yeah, but way better than Bullet. Oh yeah, way better. Like one of the best movies ever.
You got any other questions? There, and then I saw one over there, so we'll start with you.
Were you a fan of Stray Bullets when it was first coming out?
Oh yeah, yeah. I thought Stray Bullets was great.
Do you think that the resurgence in crime comics recently is largely due to you?
No, I mean, is there really a resurgence? That's what always drove me crazy. I'm going to go off on a tangent for a second. Okay, so how many superhero comics come out a month? Like 180 or something, right? But for years, anytime I would see a review of like 100 Bullets or Stray Bullets or Criminal, every reviewer always had to point out that like, oh, there's a bunch of crime comics. And I'm like, but then you're reviewing 19 superhero comics and you don't point out there's a bunch of superhero comics. Like, they were almost complaining that there were too many crime comics. I'm like, there's three. So I certainly wouldn't want to claim credit for it, but if you want to give me credit, I'll take it. The resurgence in the Winter Soldier is my fault.
There's somebody over there I saw.
Ha!
Right there.
What did you think of True Detective?
Oh, I thought it was brilliant. Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those people who will tell you that I thought the ending was perfect, and I was really, as someone who was starting to get a little bit leery of it because it was touching on so many similar things that I've been writing about in Fatale for the last 2 years, I was super relieved that they didn't do a supernatural ending. Because I was a little bit nervous. I actually had to take out a line of dialogue in an issue of Fatale because it was Matthew McConaughey said it, and I was like, God damn it! And I literally like had to go in and be like, I can't say time is a flat circle. But yeah, I haven't met that guy yet. We're at the same management company. I know he's a big comics nerd, so at some point we'll probably meet. But yeah, I thought it was brilliant. I thought, you know, and it's been a great thing for TV and for you know, just that genre in general, that Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson did TV. Suddenly every big actor that would never have even considered TV is interested in TV again, or for the first time, because they realized they could actually be on 8 or 10 hours of something where they have real dialogue instead of just, look out! Because you know, you watch movies and there's big actors who are starring in a movie and they really have 20 lines of dialogue, you know, because there's Transformers or whatever in it. So I feel like, you know, the one thing that I thought when I was watching it is, how the hell did they sell this? And then I thought, oh yeah, they have Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. Because it's so challenging and so weird, and also just like The Wire, like incredibly slow-paced at first. And I remember my wife watching the first few episodes of The Wire with me, and she's like, what the fuck is happening? Does anything happen in this show? And then after like season 3, I got her to binge watch them, and then she got totally sucked in. But I kept watching The Wire because I'm like, it's going somewhere. It's David Simon. He's a fucking genius. So, and George Pelicanos is working on it. It's got to be great.
What are your thoughts about the use of a so-called character who's the anti-hero in a noir type plot? You know, like Bogey in Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Oh yeah, I like it. I don't know. I mean, I never think about hero or anti-hero or any of that stuff when I'm writing. I'm happy for a character to just feel compelling. Like Bogey in the Treasure of Sierra Madre is great because he's so complex. You know, I mean. But I do, you know, I guess when I think about that, like, you know, are you watching Game of Thrones at all, or you know the books?
Yeah.
Like, Jaime Lannister, I remember, I hadn't read the books ever, and halfway through season one, we were all having, like, comic book summer camp at Brian Bendis' house, and Hickman and I were in adjoining rooms, and I had started reading the first Game of Thrones book, and he heard me throw it across the wall. Ned Stark? And I'm like, yeah. And I was like, I'm not reading these fucking books anymore. It's spoiling the TV show for me. And then he said, what do you think of Jaime Lannister? And I'm like, the evil guy who tried to kill a child who's screwing his own sister? Yeah, he's awful. He's like, he's my favorite character in all of fiction. What? And then now, as I've watched his development on the show, you can see he's clearly the anti-hero of that story. There's several heroes and anti-heroes in that, but his arc is more interesting because of the fact that he's a ruthless bastard in a world filled with them, you know, who's suddenly starting to grow a conscience. So that, to me, is really fascinating. I like any... The problem of being a writer is, you know... Kundera talks about this, and I don't know if any of you are Milan Kundera fans, but I am, and I like his books about writing more than his actual fiction in some ways. And he talks about, in The Art of the Novel, how a novelist cannot be political, or cannot choose a side, or cannot be writing about an issue. They have to be writing about characters. And if you're writing about a serial murderer, you have to be able to get into that person's head and understand why they've become that way. And if you're writing about a Nazi, you have to be able to understand why a person became a Nazi, or understand why a person became a fireman, or any character you're writing, you have to put yourself into their head. And I think I luckily grew up as an isolated, weird kid, growing up on traveling around from military bases and sitting in my room reading comics and drawing stories, and I, you know, have enough of a fucked up personality that I can I read an interview with Ted Bundy and totally understand him. Not that I want to murder people, but I'm like, I can, you know, I can find a way to sympathize with any character that I'm writing, even the most disgusting of them. And I think that's what you have to do as a writer, is you have to make any character who's the core of your scene, you have to somehow find a way to have sympathy for them, even if they're a despicable child killing sister lover. Jamie Lannister forever.
Any other questions? Yes.
So I really liked your run on Captain America.
Oh, thank you.
I really liked the Cap 2 movie. It seems like they're going to continue with kind of the Winter Soldier part. So I guess I was curious if there was any part of your run writing about Winter Soldier you'd like to see them continue with.
Well, yeah, I mean, all of it, right? I'm like contractually bound not to talk about a lot of this stuff, unfortunately. But yeah, I hope that they, you know, mine as much of it as they want. I'm happy with what they did. And, you know, a lot of people have asked me, are you bitter about that or anything? I'm like, no, I'm not bitter. I'm actually probably the only person I know who has a movie based on one of their books that doesn't suck. Most of my friends that have had movies made are really unhappy with the movie, like the end results. I mean, I guess Dennis Lehane is probably really thrilled with Mystic River, but I don't know him. But all of my friends who've had movies made out of their books are like, yeah, you know, you know, having seen some of my own stuff filmed and see what they cut out and what they leave in, you know, a movie's such a crapshoot about whether or not it's going to be any good. And I have a lot of friends who are screenwriters now, and they'll tell you when one of their movies comes out, oh, don't go see it. They rewrote the hell out of me. My name's just on it. And you're like, wow. So I feel lucky that, you know, that's Marvel's best movie, I think. And, you know, I totally trust those guys. I actually live around the corner from one of them now, and so he occasionally will pick my brain about things I think should be in the movies. I'm like, why are you just go read the comics? Don't tease me like this. Don't make me think I have any kind of say. Where I'm like 50s cap.
Do you have say or
no? No, I have nothing to do with those movies other than that I got to go to set a couple times and I got to be in that scene and I read a script about halfway through the writing process. I think I read one of their drafts. It was pretty close to the movie that got made. And I, you know, I didn't really have any useful feedback for them other than, like, this is great. This one scene here, you might want to tweak a little bit this way, maybe. But, like, you took the best stuff from what I did and the best stuff from what Brian and Hickman did and then added it and this whole other thing to it and made it, like, 3 Days at the Condor or something with Captain America. So I think those guys are great. And you know, the Russo brothers are amazing. I think that movie is the most cinematic looking of all the Marvel movies. And I do want to say the screenwriters, especially because you know, they were the first Captain America, and Joss Whedon got so much credit for the first Captain America because someone said, oh, Joss did a polish on that script. Like, I read that script too, and I think there might be 5 lines of dialogue in the first Captain America movie that were written by Joss Whedon. And these guys wrote every single line of dialogue in the Captain America, the Winter Soldier movie. And I know a friend of mine was like, oh, Joss Whedon totally wrote that War Games line. And I'm like, actually, I was there when they wrote that War Games line. And because that was like something they made up on the spot because they were like, Scarlett, you have something funny to say here. And so they were really like, yeah, people think Joss Whedon wrote the War Games joke. And I'm like, it's just because it's pop culture. Everyone assumes Joss Whedon's the only person in the world who knows pop culture. Like critics who write about comic book movies.
I think we got time for one more question. Anybody else?
You were pointing at somebody.
Yeah.
Is there a particular writer that you draw inspiration from or that you read and you get like an idea to maybe branch off of something that's totally different, similar?
You know, not so much anymore. I think, you know, I think it, when you write for a long time, you know, that my influences, I hope, are buried so deep that no one knows, you know, what they might be. I know, you know, Jorge and his friends would all, like, take the same idea and just write their own version of it. And I love the idea of something like that. But, I mean, the writers that inspire me and make me want to write better are people like Megan Abbott and Sarah Grahn, who are, I think, 2 of the most brilliant crime novelists working right now, and I'm drawing a blank because I was up late. I Joe Hill, I think, is one of the best novelists working today. I know his dad is Stephen King, but I think Joe's a better writer. I mean, Joe would argue with me about it, but that's his dad. But like those are the artists that inspire me. Like I want to those are people that just inspire me to try to be a better writer. Really, though, Joe Hill did give me the opening of Fatale, where someone tries to kill them by crashing a plane into them. Yeah, I just, Megan and I talking about the femme fatale sort of helped give me the idea for what I wanted to do with Fatale. So it's more just writers that I admire making me want to be a better writer. Vince Gilligan, you know, makes me want to be a way better writer than I am, to the point where I want to kill him. I know Brian Fuller a little bit, who writes Hannibal, and, you know, he makes me want to write better dialogue. So, you know, stuff like that.
Get that.
Do better, Ed.
Yeah. Sorry, I suck.
All right.
If I thought I was good, then I would try to get better.
All right. Well, I guess that's the time we have for the panel. But you said you had a signing at the Beguiling.
No. I have no. No, I'm done. I think I'm
done. You done for that?
Oh, okay. No. I'm just gonna get drunk now.
Okay.
Yeah.